Welcome to Beach Books and Beyond with me, Monique Chambers. Each week, I invite a different guest from a different walk of life to talk to me about books that they've read, which have influenced them, and books they suggest we take to the beach this summer. You've no excuse not to be well read. Welcome to Beach Books and Beyond with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Colin Fitts. Now, you'll know Colin Fitts from radio, from the stage, from presenting various awards and events, and an actor, obviously.
And also a former journalist. I was editor of a magazine, first magazine, for 4 years, and I contributed quite a lot of stuff, including working full-time for a while at the Malta Independent.
Okay.
So, the written word has been a massive part of my life.
Okay. So, what are you doing now?
What am I doing now?
We see you a lot on presenting awards and things like that. So, is that your main focus?
Not really. I do a lot of that, presenting here and there, and I do still have a radio program, and I do some broadcasting. But I have a main full-time job. I did a couple of years, last 2 or 3 years, I've dedicated myself to a sort of normal 9-to-5 job. Yes, it's which is an IT. You know, try to maybe fill the coffers, shall we say?
Yes.
Put some money aside, and then maybe go back into the media world, which has its ups and downs.
Yes.
But having that with a full bank balance
is much easier
in this life. So, so at the moment, yes, I'm dedicating myself Monday to Friday to a normal job, and doing media stuff on the weekends and in the evenings.
So you actually, do you find time to read?
I do, yes, yes, yes. I make it a point to read. I love reading. I'm one of those people who reads while he eats.
Okay.
I prefer reading a book while eating rather than having social conversation. Unless, of course, I'm interviewing someone over lunch or
something. So do you take a book with you when you, you know, go out for dinner with someone, or you actually
go? No, not that bad. But at work, my lunch break, you know, rather than gossip or just talk about nothing or what was on TV last night, I like to take a book and catch up on my reading before going to bed, of course, or in bed. That's a must. In the bathroom, that's always
also a must, especially for men. I don't know.
Love it.
Yeah,
absolutely. If I could have a whole library in there, I would.
I'm sure.
And it's not the first time that I have an evening where I'm not working, I'm free, and instead of watching television, I'd read a book or continue reading my book.
Do you like lay on the sofa and read? Are you a comfortable reader?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, and always has to be a little bit of chocolate involved, or maybe an ice cream in the summer.
So I'm thinking glass of wine. You've just
very childish. Yeah, okay. Yes, it has to be a nice sweet drink. I'm not a big alcohol drinker, you see. You wouldn't find like a smoking area with a smoking jacket and a nice.
Oh, stop shattering
chair.
My illusions.
That'll be something sweet, something a bit of cake or chocolate just to get me going, and reading my book. And then I just totally get lost in the fantasy world, whatever it is.
Have you always been a reader then? You're sort of saying it's a bit sort of childish. Have you read since you were a child?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. When I was very young, one of my first memories is of this massive library. These shelves full of books, full to bursting. I think my parents were the kind of post-war generation who, you know, didn't ever get rid of anything, didn't throw anything away. So all their school books, they never threw away, and they gathered them in this library.
Oh, lovely.
Which then, as a child, I would leaf through, fascinated by these hardbound, beautiful books. There'd be anything from encyclopedias to modern short stories, modern being 1935 or 1945, and I would be reading them in the 70s or 80s as a child. But there was still amazing, wonderful English, of course, a lot of them, some Maltese stuff as well. And yes, reading became a massive part of my life, mostly because of that library, I think.
Ah, did you work your way completely through it, or are there sections you missed?
No, there were some sections I missed. There were
the Delia Smith cookbooks, maybe, you know?
There was some of my mother's stuff and some of my mother's more recent stuff. She was into, yes, cooking and knitting and stuff like that. But there were, like, the classics. There was, like, Charles Dickens. So I would read all the Charles Dickens ones, but I would avoid the ones like Pride and Prejudice, like Jane Austen, or stuff that my mother would say, oh, yes, I had that at school. Oh, so it's a girly book. No, no, no. I found myself gravitating a lot towards the encyclopedias, uh-huh. and one book in particular was called Tell Me Why.
Okay.
A Hamlin Tell Me Why. Perhaps people listening would relate to this. I think it, many Maltese households uh-huh. in the 70s and 80s would have had a Bible,
mm-hmm.
a book, a large book containing the complete works of Shakespeare,
uh-huh.
because I've seen it in many different...
You just have to have it.
Yes, yes,
okay.
It was kind of that, there'd be a Bible, a mm-hmm. complete works of Shakespeare, an encyclopedia set,
mm-hmm.
Ours was a Caxton encyclopedia,
ooh,
six
okay.
volumes,
mm-hmm.
and Malta was in like the third or fourth volume, I remember, and it was up to 1955,
oh, sweet.
So what it said about Malta was at the conclusion, after talking about the history of Malta, was Malta is currently, under the leadership of its Prime Minister, Dom Mintoff, is seeking a form of integration with the United Kingdom to be on the similar basis to Northern Ireland.
Ooh.
And that's when the encyclopedia had been published.
Ah.
Of course, shortly afterwards, that idea didn't happen. And then we got independence, etc. But you know, it was beautiful and very informative encyclopedia.
Actually, that would be quite an interesting thing to do a play on or to write about, is what would have happened if...
That's true.
Wouldn't it?
Malta, absolutely. The what-ifs of Malta.
Yeah.
Funnily, you should mention that, because I'm currently watching a TV series on Amazon,
okay.
actually, that is based on a book I read, which I love, a science fiction book.
Okay.
I love science fiction. It's Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle. And they've just made a series about it, based on the book. And it's all about, it's 1962,
mm-hmm.
and it's in the United States. But half of the United States is the United Nazi States of America, and the other half is the United Japanese States of America. What if the Germans and Japanese had won World War II, and what would happen? And then, however, the real world, what really happened, keeps poking its nose into that universe and giving hope to the resistance, and worrying the Nazis and the Japanese, saying, oh my goodness, there's a universe where we didn't win. Anyway, so...
Oh, quite. So what's the series called?
The Man in the High Castle. But
okay.
the book is even better than the series. Fantastic
okay.
book. Philip K. Dick. But yes, what ifs about Malta? That's a great idea.
Could be quite a...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We should get together and write a script.
Mm.
What ifs? Let's talk about, very quickly, the what if moments. What important what if Malta moments. What if the referendum for the European Union was a no?
Oh, see, I was thinking of serious things like, what if twisties were never invented?
Oh, very serious things.
I might not have moved here.
You might not have moved here.
You know, they were an absolute factor, I'm afraid. You know, couldn't get them in the UK at the time.
There I am, going off on my history tangents.
So you're a big fan of history?
Twisties. I love history, yes.
Yeah.
Again, probably because of my childhood being exposed to these books, these volumes, really.
Mm.
But yes, I love history, and my favorite genre of books that I love to read is popular history. It's history written by journalist historians, so
okay.
it's in an easy style to read. It's even fun, or well, sometimes it's about massacres and things, so I wouldn't call it fun. but it's a good read, even on the beach. I think one of the first books that started this trend. Was called Stalingrad by Anthony Beevor about 15 years ago. Not this trend, not just in me, but around the world, people got into reading popular history books and taking them to the beach, and, you know, it doesn't have to be a novel for you to be entertained.
They're big block books that you can just lose yourself in.
Exactly. And they're written, they don't get lost too much in dates and statistics and facts, but they quote diaries of people who did the fighting, people who were affected by this battle and that battle. So it's not dry history, but exciting and history that involves you and makes you think, what was life like? What would I have done in that situation?
Have you read Diary of War, the Malta version? It sounds similar, where they interviewed people from different ages about on certain days. So they did a year diary.
Is that a recent? Is it a recent one? And
I've read
it
since I lived here. But,
I see. I must track it down.
It's very good. It's got a brown cover. I'll dig it up for you.
The one I have read about Malta is Fortress Malta by a journalist called a historian.
Uh-huh.
Called James Holland,
yes, yeah.
who's magnificent,
yes.
a wonderful fellow. Met him a couple of times when he was here. He looks a bit and sounds a bit like Stephen Fry.
Okay.
Yes, he's sort of tall and British and very sort of witty and that kind of stuff. But Fortress Malta, fantastic. I would recommend it to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
who wants to know about Malta and World War II.
Okay.
Not just the battles and the British perspective and the Nazi perspective and North Africa and the Italian perspective, but also the Maltese perspective, the average
citizen,
the social
history of it.
He really manages to combine everything in one big volume that is a great read, including On the Beach. It's one of these popular history books. Fortress Malta, thoroughly recommended.
Maltese should read it as well as people like me who moved here and tourists as well. It's something...
Oh, I think everybody should read it. I think it should be on the school curriculum, to be
honest. I think it's strange here because in the UK, your grandparents, everybody talk about the war all the time.
Mm.
Here, it's so unusual to hear anybody actually talking about the wars.
When I was a child, my grandmother would talk a little bit about the war, but my parents were born during the war, in the 40s, so they wouldn't actually remember it much. If you search out the people and the publications about World War II, you will find a wealth of stuff, but you wouldn't get that kind of myth as you find in Britain. That is, like, still there's the Churchillian myth, the, you know, movies still being released this year, you know, based on Dunkirk, on Churchill, three movies.
I don't want to say romanticised, because that's not their case, but it's something we sort of, the Brits seem to cling on to a bit more.
Yes, some people say it's a little bit of a superiority complex, we won the war, you know, Europe, anti-Europe thing. I wouldn't know, I wouldn't dare to go into that kind of... That's something for the Brits
to work out
for themselves. I wouldn't criticize or go along with.
Mm.
But yes, it does. It is still a very, very important part of the British myth and
the British psyche.
That's the word. Having said that, when I was a child, World War II was a massive part of my childhood. I'm talking the 70s and 80s here, and we're talking Airfix model kits of Spitfires and Messerschmitts, Commando comics. Oh my goodness! Come on, I had a massive pile of Commando comics. And
did you keep any of those, or did you?
I wish I did. I am so disappointed that I didn't.
Do you still read comics today? The sort of new versions that are out, or
that's a good question. A lot of my friends do. As I said, I'm into science fiction. I went through a phase of kind of poo-pooing them, saying, adult comics. I think they call them graphic novels, don't they?
Yes, of course.
Yes. But then a friend of mine, Adam Brimmer, his name is, lent me a book, a graphic novel, called The Watchmen. And I started reading it on a Friday afternoon, and I didn't put it down. I read it by Sunday afternoon, I had finished it.
Okay.
I spent a whole week, and I was entranced by it. And then I started to realize the magic that some of these graphic novels and why they weave their spell on so many people.
What do you think that is?
It was a very adult story. It wasn't sort of Beano or stupid Marvel comics that, like, in the movies where, you know, special powers and laser guns and things like that. Very much like the TV series Star Trek, which some people make fun of. If you actually watch a few episodes, you realize that a lot of the stories are allegories of real life. And there is a lot of depth. Even though it's lovely and colourful and glossy, and it's action and kapow and zing and punches, you know, like those old Batman TV series. When you actually read the story, you find yourself being moved and identifying with some characters and asking yourself about the decisions they have to make or are making. And there's a lot of these graphic novels that are actually very, very deep. And so I've come round to being open to reading the occasional graphic novel.
Is it because I sort of, I don't want to say I find them expensive, but you know, like in comparison to a regular book.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have a regular book or a graphic novel.
Mm.
And then you think, oh, actually I'll have a longer read with my regular book somehow. So I don't know if it's a economics of reading, if that should even come into it.
I see what you mean. It kind of, you get more value.
Yeah, as a kid, you'd want to get the comic that had something attached to it.
Yes,
even if it might not have been the best one that week, you just sort of, they got you with that thing.
The problem was, as a kid, when I used to read all the Beano and Dandy, and there was the Topper and the Beezer.
Okay.
And my parents would get me the annuals as well.
Over Christmas time.
So totally British upbringing, you know, in this little tiny Mediterranean island, you know, speaking Maltese at home, and yet having this British attitude and sense of humour, you know, on television there was Are You Being Served and Dad's Army and Hello, Hello, and then we're reading all this British humour and comedy. However, reading the Beano, we wouldn't get the little gifts on the outside of the Beano here, and then when you'd read the letters page and say, like, if you can join the the Beano or Dennis the Menace Club.
Yeah.
And then there'd be brackets, applicable only to readers from the UK and Ireland. And
I wonder if you really felt missed out.
I did, yes, I feel very, very upset. Because
you should you should have started a Beano club in Malta.
Well, I wasn't as entrepreneurial as I could have been. Yeah. A good idea, it would have been a good idea.
So any other books from childhood that you sort of, or books, comics, whatever, that you read that stuck with you that...
Well, to continue this British connection, one of the most important books that we had at school, in primary school, to learn English properly and English grammar, was called The First Aid in English by Angus MacGyver. And it wasn't just about grammar and similes and adverbs and this kind of stuff. There was a lot of general knowledge in there as well. Lists and lists of, you know, what is a... Where does an Eskimo live? In an igloo. Where does, a Red Indian, in those days they called them Red Indians, a Native American live, you know, in a teepee. So we'd learn all these things about geography. It was probably a remnant or an actual aspect of the British Empire, colonialism.
And also the strange words, because they're words that you needed to come across, so putting it into context rather than just learning a word.
True, absolutely. But there was this kind of global view. In those days. Today it would probably be seen as racist to talk about, differentiate people by the color of their skin or which part of the world they live or the habits they have.
This was in the 70s.
This was in the 70s, and the book itself was probably from the 60s, or 50s. So, but I look back and I think I had a very good solid grounding as a Maltese person in the English language, which led me to growing up to be proficient in both languages.
And is that what made you think your love of reading go into the media, going into journalism, acting, etc.?
Wanting to find out more. The aspect of the general knowledge, apart from learning how to speak English and how to write English properly, there was also this thirst for knowledge that was pressed into me by these kind of books, the Tell Me Why, the First Aid in English, which the geography books we had were amazing and really nice, really exciting in the sense that they'd explore all these different lands, part of the British Empire. Now, to us in those days, you know, the word British Empire nowadays is a bit of a dirty word.
Where? Yes.
Isn't it? Yes. But in those days, we didn't know, and to us it was just the way the world was, or the way the world was a few years before when the book was printed. But the point is, it made me excited and it made me interested in learning more about the world and more about different peoples and wanting to travel and learning more about life, and that was what led me to, number one, being interested in reading non-fiction books and trying to learn more about
history
stuff.
And not
but also led me into becoming a media person, becoming a journalist, asking why, wanting to know why, what, which, where, you know, all these important questions. And trying to just not accept things at face value, but to explore and find out as much as possible.
Do you think there could be a series, I'm thinking, you know, the Tell Me Why, for adults, re-children today, you know, Tell Me Why Fidget Spinners Are a Thing? Tell me why...
It'll probably have to be online, though, nowadays, won't it?
Yes. And tell me why,
Another good idea. We can't keep... We can't keep mentioning these ideas on air like this. We will steal them.
Tell them to me in my ear. Whisper sweet nothings.
But yes, I love the way your mind works. It's like always a twist on something. Yes, that would be an interesting thing to explore.
Write the book.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Tell us about some more books that influenced you... or books that you're reading now, for instance, things that you actually kick back and enjoy in your busy life.
Perhaps to conclude about my childhood, then there were the comic books, not the comic, the funny, the books, the comic book, the comic literature that I would read, such as Three Men in a Boat by Jerome K. Jerome, and then Three Men on the Bummel. There was Harris. There was George, and there was the author, right? And there was Montmorency, the dog, because to say nothing but the dog was the... I think I was Harris.
Yeah?
Yes. Yes, he was very down-to-earth and very sort of trying to organize things. They keep popping back into my head, little descriptions.
Harris moments and things.
But not just Harris, but also the author, Jerome, writing about George, who goes to sleep at the bank every day till 2 o'clock, except on Saturdays when they wake him up and throw him out at 12:30. Just really a totally absurd sentence there. He's meant to be working at the bank, but he goes to sleep at the bank. That's how it was written. I just thought that kind of thing was hilarious. And that kind of dry British humour stayed with me.
I remember going to work and falling asleep. And I had this trick because my I worked in marketing and this was when I was very young, and I used to fall asleep under my desk and pretend to my boss, who had this habit of when he came back into the office, he would shake his keys before he opened the door. Oh. So you'd hear the shaking of the keys, and I would sort of wake up and realise that, or pretend that I had dropped something under my desk, and actually I'd have been asleep there while he was at his meeting. Cause,
fantastic. You know, worthy of Roger the Dodger from Dandy Comic.
I was in my 20s, but you know, so I'd be going out clubbing all night and then going to work and not being able to get through all day. But yeah, so I get the sentence about going to work to go to sleep. Yeah, absolutely.
But yes, Three Men and a Boy. I love the Richmond Compton books about just William, this naughty boy,
yes.
William. And the equivalent, with the Maltese equivalent, as a child, there was a series of books by Carmel G. Kauki called Petru Petravu. This very naughty boy who would get into all kinds of scrapes. He had a heart of gold, but he was naughty, and he'd get into these kind of adventures and scrapes that always had, thank goodness, a happy ending.
Uh-huh.
But I must mention some of the Maltese stuff I read as a kid. Trevor Zara, wonderful adventure stories.
I met Trevor Zara, and I was actually a bit sort of overwhelmed.
He's brilliant, absolutely. But there was Carmel G. Kauki as well, had these books about Petru Petravu, and then as I was growing older, there were historic Maltese, they'd call them storico romantico, because a Maltese novel in Maltese
romance.
Is romance,
yes.
So it's not a romantic novel, but it's, so there'd be a lot of Maltese adventure stories, written in a style of sort of glorifying Maltese heroes, which were written in the time when Maltese patriotism and nationalism were being formed.
Mm-hmm.
A bit later than other countries, sort of in the early 1900s, I'd say.
Okay.
And in the 1930s,
the
language question, the British, the Italians, blah, blah, blah. So, and there were these books which were good adventure stories. So Rajal Bilal was one by Giuse Gallia, which I liked. And then eventually at school, my favorite book, there was a book which I liked very much, a socio-political type of book, Leli Tahazzair, Leli from the Small Village.
Okay.
Emmanuel from the Small Village by Jose Elul Mercer.
Okay.
Which is about this young man from a small village, you know, whose life is dominated by the church and being poor, and he tries to up his station and read books and in the end he ends up going mad because everybody ostracizes him, and it's almost like at the end of the book it's kind of the writer is saying he should know his place and shouldn't have tried to escape the confines of you know the station he was born in,
his life setting.
But it was obviously more than that. It was an allegory, it was a commentary on the working class and all that. Very, very interesting book. And then, of course, more recently, there's a whole bunch of Maltese books that have been coming out, which are a good read.
Uh-huh.
You know, which with the Merlin, for example, has a lot of, and I occasionally do end up reading one of the Maltese books, but because they're novels and they're not really my genre, I don't read as much as I'd like to.
Uh-huh.
I always go back to reading my.
So, what are you reading at the moment?
Popular history. Well, at the moment, I am reading a book about Africa.
Okay. Military history again? Or?
It isn't actually. It's called The State of Africa by Martin Meredith. And it goes around every single African state.
Mm-hmm.
The edition I'm reading, unfortunately, isn't completely up to date. The one I bought. It's, for example, Libya is still just a few years or a couple of years before Gaddafi got overthrown. But it goes through every single African state since independence, and most of them got their independence just before Malta or slightly after Malta, so 50s and 60s. And it explores their history and their presidents, and it doesn't hold back. Martin Meredith, the author, doesn't hold back and criticizes both the colonial states that could have done so much more to improve these countries, or if possible, maybe not colonize them at all in the first place. So he doesn't say that. He explores the stories of each country, but he doesn't just say, okay, it's all because of colonialism. He also explores the mistakes that Africans themselves have made by electing the wrong people, the corruption, and that kind of stuff. And he looks into the aid that is sent to Africa, what's been happening with the aid, the amount of money, and why Africa doesn't seem to have made as much progress as all the aid that was sent to Africa should have done.
Lots of corruption.
So it's a really interesting book, and it's, again, very well written, and it doesn't pull its punches, you know, it criticizes wherever, it's not politically correct and says, oh no, it's all about colonialism, and on the other hand, it doesn't just blame everything on the Africans, it does state where the European nations, you know, were mistaken in what they did, and the reason why they made... why Africa is in such a state.
So, anything else that you've read recently, or you're going to be reading next? What's on your reading list, or what else can you tell us about that we should be?
Well, I mean, I love my World War II books, so there's always something maybe by James Holland that I'd love to read, and I love Lawrence Rees and his "The Nazis: A Warning from History," which was also a TV series, documentary series. But I particularly love it because it really goes into the corruption and the really nitty-gritty of how the Nazis ruled Germany before and during World War II. So when sometimes I hear people say, oh, well, the Nazis were so efficient, you know, I mean, and, you know, I mean, and you hear that these people are sometimes Maltese. And I think to myself, first of all, the Nazis, from reading this book, you realize that there was a lot of corruption and nepotism going on within something that seemed so efficient and Germanic and perfect. And secondly, if the Nazis had won World War II, we Maltese would have been considered pretty subhuman.
Yes.
So, you know, I could never get my head around...
We'd have been their Riviera, probably, actually.
They'd have got rid of us Maltese, at least, and kept all the Aryans to, you know, to enjoy our beaches and whatever. Richard Overy and his books, he's also very good. This is all about mostly World War II and why the Allies won, and going into not just the basic story of World War II, but the reasons behind certain victories and why certain decisions were taken.
So it's still important to keep those stories alive and not just focus on the Knights' history that we sort of regurgitate very often in Malta. We sort of miss this chunk of
World War II. Absolutely, there was so much about World War II in Malta that needs to be taught and needs to be read about, and could be discussed not and on radio and on television. So much more. The whole Knights era is brilliant and great. And very exciting, but it's overexposed.
Yes.
And to conclude, I suppose I can't not mention my favorite author, Neil Ferguson. Mm-hmm. He's a historian, but also an economist, and he's written the book, my favorite book of all time, which is called The War of the World. Not The War of the Worlds, The War of the World. I like The War of the Worlds.
Yes,
it's a good novel, of course. But The War of the World is all about the 100 years, 1900 to 1999. And how many people died, and the reasons, how it wasn't just World War I, World War II, but also how the Jews and the Holocaust, part of the Holocaust had been going on from way before the Nazis got into power, you know, there was certain kind of blah, blah, blah. So Neil Ferguson, anything by him that's coming out, I'll be first in line to get it, and
we'll be jumping over you at the beach to get it.
Yes, and I'll be reading
beach
it.
Libraries.
As I said, it's popular history, it's really easy to... Really easy to take in, and a good read. It's not just like bare facts and dates and statistics.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much. That's Colin Fitz talking to me on this week's Beach Books and Beyond.
Thank you for joining me, Monique Chambers, on this week's Beach Books and Beyond. I'd also like to thank Samuel Attard and Carmelo Brett for helping me to produce this programme. Join us again next week for Beach Books and Beyond, here on Campus FM.